Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Jen from Auburn, PA.
Feel free to grip that up.
Hi, my name's Jen. I'm an alcoholic. Hello, family. All right, so let's start at the beginning. My sobriety date is May 11th, 2011. I have a home group. It's Freedom from Bondage. We meet in Wyomissing, Pennsylvania at Atonement Church at 6:30 on Sunday nights. I have a sponsor, and I have sponsor women through the 12 steps. So that's the beginning of what my sobriety looks like. Let's go back a little further, I guess, right? The interesting stuff. So I grew up in a really regular, normal family from the outside. I have two brothers, and my parents were together until I was about 25. I grew up in a house where, and in a family where education was really important, being smart was really important, and following the rules was really important. My dad is, I believe, an alcoholic. He sees differently, and so does the majority of my other family, and that's okay. He is unpredictable. He was never violent, but he was extremely terrifying as a child. I grew up very fearful of my world around me and what that looked like, and constantly made my decisions based on what would keep me safe. So my mom was the breadwinner in my family. She was the doctor and the smart one, and my dad was the stay-at-home dad. So he was home every night when I got back from school, and he would say, "How are you?" And I'd say, "Fine." He'd say, "Great." And that was about the extent of our interactions growing up. And my mom would work till really late at night, and then she'd come home, and she'd be like, "How's your homework? Are you okay? Like, let's talk." And so, like, I had this really amazing, loving parent who could, like, never be there, and then this really horribly scary parent who was always there. And it made it hard to want to be home. So I spent a lot of time trying to find reasons not to be home. I'm the kind of kid who didn't like to go to recess because I couldn't interact with the other kids because I didn't understand what it was like to be a kid. I don't know how to naturally let go and be free. That's not a state that comes naturally to me. What comes naturally to me is to be, like, frozen in fear, checking out what's around me, how can I make everything stop, and how can I be okay, and do you like me? Are you okay? Am I okay? Are we all okay? Like, what's happening right now? Because I'm going to die. That's my natural go-to state. So as a child, I'm not a lot of fun. So I would go in from recess, and I would hang out with the secretaries because they would give me these little jobs to do, and they were really nice to me, and they just thought I was cute. And they're like, "Oh, come in, little girl." And I'm like, "Let's make cubbies." And that was what I did because it made me feel useful and purposeful, and that's a thing that I found out later. It's something that I'm always looking for. How do I be useful? How do I be purposeful? I don't know how to do that. So I went through school, and I got to junior high, and I started to see these kids that, like, looked kind of messed up. Like, I felt kind of messed up, and they were weird, and I was weird. And, like, they were on the outside what I felt on the inside, which was broken and defective and not quite right and just, like, weird. And they were the goth kids. I was a super righteous goth girl, very angsty. And it suited me because it was weird, and it kept you away from me. But then if you got past that, then I could trust that you really were interested in me, and you weren't scared by the other stuff, and that made it okay. Like, that was, like, my safety net of, you're not going to think I'm a freak, because you already see that I am, so yay. So that was great. I skipped a very important part, which was my first drink. I, for my first 2 years of sobriety, did not remember the first time that I drank, and was really jealous of other people that did, because they would always talk about, like, "Oh, I had a drink, it was so warm, it was so great and all wonderful," and I'm like, I don't remember that. And then it's just one of those things that comes back to me after, you know, like, just like everything comes back to you after a little bit, just shows up one day. And I was, I think, like 11 or 12 years old, and I went to this banquet for, like, the one club that I did, which was riding horses, and it was, like, the only thing I had any interest in growing up, really. And I went out to, like, the bartender, because you could get, like, whatever you wanted, and I love Shirley Temples, and I still do. I think they're delicious. And I went up there, and I was like, "My name is Shirley Temple." And he was like, "Sure." And I did that, like, over and over and over and over again. And probably at, like, number 3 or 4, he leaned over the bar, and he's like, "I put something special in for you this time." And I don't know, like, in retrospect, I don't know what kind of creep does that to, like, a little girl. But I was like, okay. And I'm like, I have no idea. Because my family, like, my dad drank, but it was very secretive and kind of hidden. So I didn't really have a lot of exposure to what, like, a drunk person looked like. So I drank it, and I was like, this is amazing. Best Shirley Temple ever. And I went back and back and back and back. And I can tell you what I was wearing that day. I can tell you the way it felt. I can tell you how I ended up slumped down in this stairwell. And I was like, this is right. This is the best thing ever. And it was great. And I didn't know then what would happen because I had gotten drunk. I was like, it didn't occur to me till 2 years into sobriety that that's what that was. So anytime I ever go, like, maybe I could just have one. I'm like, I couldn't have one thinking it was a Shirley Temple. Like, I can't have one. That's not a thing that I do ever. So missed that part. Fast forward. Junior high, here I am. Angsty teen. And so, like, my friends, like, they drank and they smoked pot, and that was great. And I was like, let's do that. That sounds amazing. I want to do all the things that you're doing because I want you to like me. So whatever I need to do to make that happen sounds great to me. And I did some other stuff, and they were like, ooh, Jen, that's a lot of that. And I'm like, ooh, okay, we'll just drink. Because that's, like, a little illegal. I mean, I know I'm only 16, but, like, it's not, like, illegal. And that was how I made it okay. I love to find reasons to justify my drinking, and I'll twist and manipulate and turn whatever my world needs to be to match it up, right? Like, I lower my standards to meet my drinking, and that's a consistent behavior that I do. So that's what I did, and it was great, and they were great, and we did that thing, and that was how I bonded with people and connected with people, and it allowed me to be this person that was funny and pretty and smart and wanted and loved, because as it turns out, big fear, dying alone, and then I'm unlovable. And a lot of my stuff is based out of that, like my motivations and why I do the things that I do are to make sure that you're going to continue to love me and not leave me. So I hung around with people who drank like I drank. Awesome. So nobody said anything. So I went away to college. I picked the school that I picked because it was a 3-to-1 ratio to men to women. And I figured, well, I'm never going to have to buy another drink ever. And I didn't. And it was great. You know, like, it was awesome. And I was like, I'm going to find a man up here. And I picked this college major because I was like, I'm definitely getting in. And I did. And it was far enough away from my family. It was about 2.5 hours. Where, like, they would not drive 2.5 hours and not say, like, hey, Jen, we're coming to visit. But they were also there in case I needed them. Because I keep you around because I need you. Like, I need to take advantage of you. I don't really like you. I don't really want you around. What can I get from you? That's what's important to me. So, college, yay, and drinking, and I matched up with everybody else, right? Like, I was able to maintain it in a way that looked the way that it looked for you. As that kind of went on, somewhere in there it stopped being so much fun. I didn't really have any consequences then. You know, we just snuck in the dorm and did the regular stuff, and nobody really said anything, and it was fine. And I got done with my major, and about my senior year, I decided that that was not, I didn't want to be a graphic designer because that's what I'd gone to school for. I was like, I don't like sitting behind a computer. I'm a people person. No, I'm not. Like, I am not a people person. I don't like people by nature. That's not a thing I do. But that was, again, the thing that I do to turn my thing, my the way that I can manage my drinking. Like, I don't want to get a real job because I'm not ready to be an adult. And that's what I told my mom. I'm not a wannabe a graphic designer. That's not a thing I want to do. And just like Bill and his story of, like, not, you know, like, the law, not for me. I'm going to do this other thing now. Like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do this other thing now. And so she was like, well, you can come home, but you either have to get a job full time or you have to go back to school. Back to school, right? Because that accommodates my drinking. That's what it allows me to do. I can go to school. I can take late classes so that I can drink at night, be hungover, get up, get enough time to sleep, shower, get my life together a little bit, go out to school, finish a little homework, go out drinking. And that's a pattern that I followed until for another 2 years while I went to school for some more stuff. So I went to school to be a teacher, and I picked that because everyone said that that'd be something I'm good at, because I don't know how to make choices. I don't know what I'm good at. I don't know what I like. I do what you tell me I said that I like, that I'm good at. That seems like a safe bet to me, and everyone said I'd always be good at that. Awesome. How hard can it be to be an art teacher? I'll be off in the summers. It'll be awesome. Yeah, so that did not work out. Because I picked a major from a school that's like the best in the country. Like, I went to Kutztown, and they're like one of the best art education schools in the country. Do you know how hard it is to find an art education job around here? It borderlines on impossible. And I didn't bother to look at that because I don't plan ahead. What feels good right now? I need to get drunk. I need to find ways to do that. Let's do that. Great. Awesome. So I found a job. I somehow found like this long-term subbing job with a school that I student taught at, and it was awesome. And what happened was I moved to Boyertown because I make impulsive decisions and don't ask anybody if they're a good idea or not. And I was like, I'm going to move to Boyertown because they're totally going to hire me after this because they're going to see how amazing I am. Because that's what the point is, right? Like, you have to think I'm amazing for me to think I'm amazing. And we got to make sure that that's what's going to happen. So we're good. I got to be there. I've got to plan ahead. It's just all so twisted. So what ended up really happening was that I just drank a lot. I did my job and I drank a lot. And there wasn't anybody there to say, we're concerned about you. Because there wasn't anybody nearby. All my friends still lived in Reading. So at the end of the semester, they were like, thanks. Bye. And I was like, wait, you're not going to like offer me like a job or like how great I am? What? And they were like, well, you can substitute teach if you want. And I was like, alright, that sounds okay. Yeah, newsflash, I don't do change well, and substitute teaching is nothing but change. So I found out that that was horrible and I hated it. So I started applying for other jobs. And I probably applied to over 200, anything within a 100-mile radius of Reading. I ended up with about 4 or 5 interviews where I'd get to the very end. Because if you don't know this, teaching interviews, you have to go through like 4 or 5. It's like a grueling process. And I would get to the end, and they'd be like, oh, Jen, so you're great. We dig you. But here's this other person that has this other thing that's just like a little better than you are. Fine. Sure. Which was a thing that had happened to me my whole life. Because my brother is super smart, like freaky smart. And he was always just better at stuff than I was. He was like, he was handsome, and he was more athletic and smarter and more charismatic, and people liked him. Like, I was two or three years older than he is. I still am. That's how that works. And I went to high school, and my high school teachers were like, oh my gosh, are you Tom's sister? And I'm like, how do you know him? He's in junior high, man. Like, that is not how that's supposed to work. But that's how it worked, right? Like, I'm always just a little bit behind everyone else. So that just like stirred up all my crazy. And I didn't know what to do. So I got this job selling glasses and it seemed fine because they opened a little later and I didn't always have to be the first one there. And I was sick a lot. You know, not sick enough to stay home, but like a lot of sick at work. And I just had lots of gastro problems, and I couldn't tell you why. I'm just very sensitive. So I'm a very delicate flower, as it turned out. And I went through my life, and I had been diagnosed with depression and anxiety since 14. I've been in therapy since that long time and been on medication, and none of that stuff stopped me from drinking because none of that stuff is about my alcoholism. It's important information to have. It's important stuff to deal with. But that is not why I drank. And those things were 100% amplified because I drank. And I missed the part where my doctor was like, you're not going to want to drink on these meds because then they're not going to work for you. I just did not hear that. Even though, as it turned out, every bottle he'd ever given me was labeled and said that. I missed it. And I'm sure not on purpose. Right. So I just kind of like wandered through life trying to like figure out like what's next. Like, is this what people do? And I found a group of friends that seemed nice enough and they liked me enough and they drank like I drank and cool. This is great. I can do this. This is like adult life. Like, I'm living with somebody. I have bills. She pays way more than I do, but that's because her job's better. Not my fault. And you know, it just was fine. Get people. It was great, you know, and then it wasn't. And then it just started to get harder. And I started to, like, not always remember exactly what would happen. I was always the first one drinking. I started to do the thing where, like, oh, you need another drink? Like, let me get you one. And then I would get us four, two for me, two for you, right? I'd get my two done. You're still finishing one. Oh, don't, I'll just finish this one for you, and then I'll get us some more. And I did stuff like that to, you know, hide what I was doing. And I just did weird things like that. And I would sit in the bar with my girlfriend, and she'd be like, I can only have a couple tonight because I have to work in the morning. I'm like, okay, just do what she does. And she would have, like, her Jack and Coke and her Jack and Coke and her Amstel Light, and then she'd be done. So I would try to pace my drinking with that, and I was like, well, I don't really like those drinks, so I'll drink my drink. Well, my drink's beer, so that's, like, not the same. So I could have, like, two of those to one of hers. So, okay, it's, like, two and one and two and one, and then, I mean, her last one's a beer, but it's, like, I mean, my beer's better, so it tastes better, so it's fine. Like, I don't know. I, like, somehow made it okay and would try to match the drinking. That would never work, and I found out later what that's really about is, you know, that's me pacing myself and trying to control my drinking. And I didn't want to see that when I first got here. I was like, I never tried to control my drinking. Like, I just drank, and I never thought about controlling it. I always thought about controlling it. So, so at about somewhere around 25, I'd start calling my friends on a Tuesday, and I'd be like, guys, let's go out, it's Tuesday. And they're like, Jen, it's Tuesday. Like, we have work. And I was like, I mean, so do I. Yeah, me too. Okay. Don't get it. And they said, no, like, it's Tuesday. Like, we have to work in the morning. Like, we can't come out tonight. Okay. I'll just go by myself. So, that's what I started to do. I just went out and I would do, like, I would do work out of the bar. Like, I would write my schedule for my employees at the bar. Totally seemed normal to me. Did not seem weird that it's 1 in the morning, I'm wasted, and I'm doing a grid schedule for an entire, you know, like, clothing store. That's totally fine. Not weird at all. And that's what I would do. And then I would get in my car, and I would drive home, and I would say that is okay. There's a part in the big book that talks about that I do socially unacceptable things, and I read that with my sponsor, and she asked me what socially unacceptable things I did, and I said I didn't do socially unacceptable things, and I didn't know what she was talking about. She goes, don't we have a law about driving drunk? And I was like, yes. She's like, did you ever do that? Yes, but I never got caught, so it's okay. And she's like, that's not how that works. Socially unacceptable means I do things that society says is not okay. Yeah, I did that all the time. You know, I took your boyfriend home, socially unacceptable. I drive drunk, socially unacceptable. I don't always pay all my bar tab because I didn't have all those drinks. You must have marched 2 minutes down. Like, socially unacceptable to lie to people, okay. But, like, I do that stuff. So I ended up starting to hang out with people who 100% were alcoholics the way that I'm an alcoholic. Because my friends before, turns out, I think they're hard drinkers because their life took a different turn. And they were like, oh, I have to go to work now. I have a job. I want to have a family. I want to do these things. So I'm going to stop drinking. And that is just weird to me. I still think that that's bizarre. Like, how do you just not want to get wasted all the time if you can? Because they're not alcoholics. It's not important to them. It just doesn't matter so much. So I found some friends that didn't think that. And they were like, let's get wasted all the time. And I was like, that's a great idea. So that's what I did. I still had a car. I found a guy who always had money, and we hung out all the time. And I was everywhere in the middle of Reading and late at night in alleyways doing things I'm not supposed to be doing. And what I will tell you about that is all the other stuff that when I got here, I heard people talk about, you know, what they drank, what they did, and all these things. And I go, I just drink beer, man. Like, I just drink beer. And the reason I just drank beer was because I knew enough about this program. My mom went away to treatment when I was a kid to know that there's certain things that, like, really make you an alcoholic, right? Like, they really, like, if you're drinking hard liquor, like, man, you're an alcoholic. Like, that's just what that is. So to me, if I could just drink beer, then I wasn't this thing. So it was okay. Couldn't have told you any of that then. That's one of those things that showed up later when I got sober and looked back and goes like, oh, there I go justifying my behaviors again and why it's okay that I do these things when it's really not okay. So one day I was 27 I was insanely depressed. I'd done a litany of random things and men and stuff I wasn't real proud of. And I'd call my mom in the morning and cry to her because she was my drinking buddy at this point because my parents had gotten divorced and she'd started drinking again. So, and I would call her in the morning and I would cry and say, oh my God, I did this thing and I did this horrible stuff and blah, blah, blah. And she would say, you know, like, you're just having a hard time right now. You're just going through something. This will get better. It's going to be fine. And what started to happen was I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel anymore. Right? Like, I couldn't see how this ever got better. And I'm not the kind of alcoholic that ever wished to die or thought about suicide or wanted to kill myself. But that's was just not part of my story at this point. That's not been the thing that I thought about. But what I did actively think about was what it would be like if I disappeared. Not necessarily died, but just ceased to exist. You know, like, and I would think about what would happen if I just, like, drove off a bridge or anything, or, you know, what would happen. I didn't ever have any plan to, like, do those things, but I often wonder what it would be like if I wasn't here anymore. And as it turns out, that is not a normal thought process. I did not know that not everyone thought about driving off a cliff when they drove by one. I don't think about that hardly ever anymore today. I thought about it every single time I drove by a guardrail. What happened if? So at 27, I woke up on a day like was any other day. I had been out. At this point, I started to black out. I didn't start to black out till towards the very end of my drinking. I was drinking every day. I couldn't tell you how much. I just know it was a lot and it was often. And I did my drinking out in public as much as I could, at least at some point in the day, because that somehow made it okay. And I started drinking at a bar that was down the street from my house. It was actually a bar that my dad used to take me to as a child. And he would sit me in the bar and he would drink, and he would justify that behavior to my mother by saying, well, there's trains on the ceiling. She likes to watch the trains. And that's how I ended up going back to the bar. That's how I made that okay with me, like, I'm going to go relive my childhood. I'm going to go check out these trains. And ignored the fact that this bar was 2 blocks away from my house. 3 blocks. Whatever. Away from my house. And that's really what I was doing there, was that the bar that I went to in the city was just too far away and too big of a chance to take anymore because I still hadn't had any outside consequences. But, like, that couldn't last forever. So I sat in that bar and I met this guy and I went in and out throughout the night and I remember being like, what's your name? And he would be like, and he would say it, and I could see him saying it, and I couldn't remember it. And I asked him like 1,000 times throughout that night. None of that was unusual. I'd done that 1,000 times before. Took that dude home, woke up the next morning, and he was gone, and I could not remember his name. And again, not unusual, not out of the ordinary, just regular. What was out of the ordinary that morning was I had made a doctor's appointment at like 8 in the morning. Like, I did not do stuff before double digit time, like 10, 11, 12, then we do things. Anything before that, no. And I'd made this 8 o'clock appointment because my depression medication wasn't working anymore and I needed you to fix it. Like, that's what I needed. I needed, because not drinking was not on the table. Like, that was not a thing. That was an option. I need you to give me a pill and fix me, please. Thank you. So I made this appointment, and I, like, poured myself out of bed, still drunk, smelled really bad, don't know where dude is, hope all my shit's here. Ooh, I'm sorry. Hope all my stuff's here. And so I got to the doctor's office, and so I'm driving there. All I can think about was, what was his name? What was his name? What was his name? And I got to that doctor's office, and I still couldn't remember his name. And for whatever reason, that was my moment of clarity. You know, and my favorite speaker in the whole wide world, Kent, from Sandusky, Ohio. Kent C. is awesome. And he says that the moment of truth, that your moment of clarity is the moment that God stops the liar in you long enough for you to see the truth, and that's what happened to me that day. that for just that little second, I saw my life for what it really was. And it was that I was not okay. And that this, none of this was normal. And that none of this had to be the way that I lived my life. Like, this was not what was supposed to have happened to me. And that's not what I wanted. And I went into that doctor's office. I couldn't tell you what I said to him. I just know that I cried a lot. And I'm sure I probably asked for help. I don't know what that looked like. And he said, go home. I'm going to call your mom. We're going to try and find a place for you. I said, okay. And nobody had ever said, Jen, you drink too much. I've never had a DUI. Those things just didn't happen. I've never lost a job. No one ever questioned any of the things that I ever chose to do. And I got in the car, and I got about half a mile away. I can tell you the stoplight that I was at when my brain went, it was Mark. Mark with the C. That was his name. You're fine. It's okay. Stop freaking out. And I heard myself say that, and I was like, oh my God, I am so messed up. Like, I just did it again. I just tried to make it okay. I just tried to make all the things that I've done okay, and this is not okay. I'm not okay. This is, none of this is how it should be. And so I went home, and the doctor called me, and he said, we can't find a place for you for 3 days. Try not to drink. Okay. And I'm going to tell you what, I didn't drink for 3 days, and that's not me. I don't not drink for 3 days because I don't want to, or because I'm scared. I might not drink for 3 hours. I'll give you that, but not 3 days at that stage of my life. But I didn't. And I don't know what God looks like in your life, but that's what God looks like in mine. I went away to treatment for 21 days. I don't know that everyone needs to go to treatment. My mom didn't go a second time, and I know plenty of people that don't. But I did, and it worked for me. They put me in a place that had an alarm on the door, but they said, if you want to leave, you can leave. And good news is that life of fear made it really scary to leave a place like that. It's like, I don't want to set the alarm off, so I'm just going to stay right here. And I would call my mom, and I would say, come and get me, and she would say, nope. And she was still actively drinking and knew enough to know that if she kept right on drinking, that they were going to tell her that that I couldn't see her anymore. And she knew me well enough to know that I lived in so much fear that I was going to listen. So she started going back to AA, and her life got better. She's about 2 weeks behind me in sobriety. And she loved me enough to leave me there, even though I called her pretty much every day and begged her to please come and get me. I cried solidly for about a week and a half. I don't think I stopped. I was the girl that was in, like, the sweatpants my shirt. I couldn't manage my life. And just shuffled to, like, everything and cried. And just, I was a disaster. But I showed up, right? Because that's what they said you had to do, was just show up. I'm like, come on, it's time to go.
Okay.
I can tell you the only time I broke a rule in rehab was that I slept during one lecture. That's right, rebel, right here. But again, one of the times in my life when my fear has actually worked in my favor. So at the end of my stay, they tried to get me to stay longer, but I just didn't have the money, and there wasn't any funding that they could get for me. And they said, I had decided at that point, like, I was just going to do whatever they said. Because when I was there, I had met this woman named, if anyone's from Reading, you might know a woman named True. And True, I met her at a meeting, and she was, like, really happy. And I thought, that was interesting. I didn't know anybody that was really, like, happy like that. And she just, hello. And she's like, call me when you get back to the rehab. And I was like, okay. And I did, because she told me to, and I run a life on fear, and I was afraid she was bigger than me, and I didn't want to see her if I didn't call. So I called her, and she talked to me, and I don't even know about what, but I do remember is when she got ready to get off the phone with me, she said, I love you. And I could not tell you the last time that I heard somebody say that. And I don't mean, like, heard it, but I mean, like, heard it, somebody say that they loved me. You know, my mom told me all the time, but I just did not internalize that or feel that. And how can you when you're that drunk and that self with just crazy fear and self and ego? I can't hear that stuff. And I heard it. And I just thought, I'm just going to do whatever these people say because I suck at life. I'm really bad at it. Like, that is a for sure thing. And so I was like, I'm just going to do whatever they say. I'm going to do that. And I was getting ready to leave, and they said, you know, we're going out to one more meeting. You need to get numbers. So I went to the last meeting, one of the last meetings that I went to out there, and they, I went to this meeting, and I found the cutest, littlest old lady who turned out to be a retired kindergarten teacher. So, like, super sweet, just full of, like, love and puppies and kittens and rainbows and glitter. Like, I was like, okay, you don't seem like you're terrifying to me. You sound okay. And I went up to her and I said, my name's Jen, I'm at the rehab and I gotta get numbers, you know, and she's like, I love you, okay, here's my phone number. And I was like, oh my God, she loves me too. What's happening in my life, man? Like, and at least, and she was just kind to me. Like, she didn't want anything, she didn't ask for anything, she didn't need anything. She just said, here's my number, call me when you get out. I'll meet up with you. Okay. And I went to my little meeting with my counselor and they were like, okay, we think you should go home. I'm sorry, what? What's that now? Go home? You met me? I'm insane. I've been crying for 3 weeks. I'm in that job. I need medication. I need help. I need therapy. I need long-term, all the stuff. I'm a wreck. And they go, no, we think that you're pretty willing. And if you go to AA, we think you're going to be okay. We think you should go to outpatient and do some other stuff because you're obviously nuts. But, like, all intents and purposes, you're okay. Like, this is going to be okay. You just keep doing what you're doing. You've not even here. What? All right. Okay. So I went home. I lived with a girl who had a boyfriend who has shown up in the rooms over time. He came home one night at, like, 3 in the morning, totally wasted, breaking stuff in my house. And I did the thing that terrified me more than anything, which was that I called somebody because I was afraid and I didn't know what to do. And I really wanted to be angry at him, but I was just really, really scared. And he brought alcohol home, and I didn't know what to do with that information. And I called somebody, and she answered the phone at 3 in the morning. And she said, oh my gosh, I couldn't sleep. I'm so glad you called. Let's talk. And she talked to me for an hour. And she didn't want anything from me. And that is a thing that consistently happens for me in AA. That I show up and I ask for help and nobody wants anything from me. And I don't have friends like that. So that was very interesting and very appealing to not be wanted for something, because I'm the kind of girl that, you know, shows my cha-chas and, you know, I'm that girl because I know that I've got something going on and I would like for you to know that so that I can get what I want. And you guys didn't care about any of that stuff. You just wanted to be helpful. And I didn't know what that was like. So I went through early sobriety asking, why? Because I need to know. Turns out, says so in the big book like 1,000 times, self-knowledge doesn't fix me. Knowing why doesn't fix me. And that's great information, and sometimes it's helpful on my journey. And it was never explained so simply to me as the woman who answered the phone at 3 in the morning said to me, Jen, if your house is on fire and everything you love is inside, and I hand you a hose and I say, turn the hose on, Jen, it's going to fix the problem. You going to turn the hose on? Obviously, I'm going to turn the hose on. Don't be ridiculous. And she's like, yeah, you're not turning the hose on right now, Jen, because you're an alcoholic and all you want to know is this water filtered? Who's paying for this water? Did you make this hose? Where did this hose come from? Are you sure? I'm going to need you to explain the chemical reaction that happens when water hits fire, please. Thank you. Right? Like, that's the stuff that I do. Like, no. Turn the hose on. This thing works. You say your life's a wreck. I say my life was a wreck. This is what I did to fix it. Why don't you just try that? I learned that the word willingness means maybe. That's all it means. Because I like to make things really complicated. I don't know about you guys. that I'm the alcoholic that's like, I need you to describe for me what willingness means and what it looks like. I'll need a diagram and a spreadsheet. Thank you. And all it is maybe, right? Like, maybe God's a thing. Maybe this works for me. Maybe you aren't all full of it. And that was it. Just maybe. And I could buy into maybe. You all seemed pretty happy. You clearly drank like I drank. I heard your stories. And you didn't do that anymore. And you said your life was better. Okay. So, at about 3 years sober, I'd been through 5 sponsors and I hadn't done 4 stuff. Carried a lot of shame about that for a really long time. Because I thought I was doing something wrong. And then somebody pointed out to me that I'd done exactly what AA told me to do, which is to suit up and show up every day. Do you have a sponsor? I always have a sponsor. You have a home group? I always have a home group. You get to that meeting? Every time. Do you have a service commitment there? Yep. It'll happen for you when it happens, Jen. Stop trying to run everything. And the truth is, I don't think that you should delay on your 4-step. However, that is the course that my life took. And quite frankly, I was a train wreck. And I don't know that I was prepared to do a 4-step or look at any of my stuff. Because anytime anybody even said that my shirt was the wrong color, I fell to pieces. So, I just kept doing what other people told me to do because I had consistently proven that I was not any good at it. I would have a sponsor and she would relapse and I would have a sponsor and she would say, we're going to start again. Oh, we're at step 3? I'm moving to Malibu. I've gotten a new job. And I'd get a new sponsor and she'd say, okay, we're going to start again. I already did these steps. I know, but we're going to do it again. All right. And then I had a sponsor and we were at step 3 again. And I got stuck on the decision, right? Because I want to make a decision like a whole thing. And that's not what step 3 is. You know, step 3 is the decision. Like, I'm willing to say, like, I'm going to do the rest of the work now. I'm going to plan this trip to Massachusetts. I'm going to get in the car. I have all the stuff. God's driving. Yes. Step 3. That's it. I'm in the car. Got it. Right? Like, that's what step 3 is. Step 3 is getting in the car. I want to make step 3 this whole big thing where, like, step 3 means that I am now driving from behind God's steering wheel, and I'm just like, it's okay, I got this. Right? Like, that's what I want to make step 3, and that's not what it is. Step 3 is I got in the car. So before I figured that out, my sponsor and I went to a convention, which, if you don't know what that is, are these really cool things that we do over a weekend. And we all get together, and we hang out, and we have ice cream, and we go see speakers, and we have a dance, usually, and we hang out and do fun things at a hotel. And you get to, I order room service, because that makes me feel special. So that's what we did. And we're sitting there, and she's arguing with me about what step 3 is, and she finally says, you know, Jen, I don't think you hear me. I think you should go pray about it and go sit outside and wait for someone to come explain it to you. Okay, Kathleen. I'll go pray about it. And so I, like, marched outside, and I went and had my cigarette, and nobody came. And I was so excited to go back in and tell her. And I marched right back in there. I was like, Kathleen, nobody came up to talk to me about step 3. I don't think God's real. And she said, did you pray about it? No. She said, well, you might want to try that and give it another shot. Okay, Kathleen. So I walked out. I was like, okay, God. Is it real? Help me figure out a decision on step 3. Whatever. Help. And I sat down and had another cigarette, and this woman walks over to me and she says, hi, I'm Becky. How are you? I'm fine, Becky. And we sat down and we talked, and she was one of the first people that I heard that didn't have outside consequences the way that I didn't have outside consequences, and that when she went away to rehab, nobody understood where she went. They all thought she died. Same. And I was like, oh, rats. And I asked her, what do you think about step 3? And we talked, and I don't know what she said, but it made sense. Of course it did, as it always does, because God does for me what I can't do for myself, which is basically everything. And I asked her, did Kathleen send you? And she said, who's Kathleen? I'd love to meet her. She's your sponsor. She sounds great. And I was like, come on, we'll go meet Kathleen. So we met Kathleen. I go back to that convention and I see Becky because she does service at that convention. She now does that exact same thing with her sponsees. Ha. I was real mad that that worked. And I don't know that God always works in such obvious ways, but that's what I needed right then for this to work for me. And so that's what he provided me with. So I finally got down a 4-step. It was wildly uneventful. I know a lot of people that talk about how great and uplifting and freeing it was for them, and I'll tell you, nothing in my sobriety has been this crazy, dramatic, white light, like, oh my God, moment. I don't know what that's like. That's awesome if you have that. I'm super jealous. I have the educational variety. I grow over a period of time, which I hate because I want to see that I've grown right now. I want to know that I'm better than I was yesterday, right now. I want to be free, right now. And that's just not what any of my sobrieties look like. I did a 4-step, did the 5th step with my sponsor, and she's like, how do you feel? And I was like, exactly the same. She said, okay, go home and do the meditation. And I did, and I was like, okay, done. Yee. And I don't know what changed in that moment for me, because really nothing in that moment changed for me. But what did happen for me was that over a period of time, I can tell you that I look back on my life, and every time I think, like, I have nailed life and I am killing it right now, I look at a year back and I'm like, oh, it was a mess. And then, like, another year goes by and I'm like, why was I thinking I was doing so well? Like, I was a train wreck at 2 years. Like, 3 years is me, I got this. And then, like, you know, year 4 comes and I'm like, oh my God, 3 years, I was insane. But, like, that's what happens. Like, that's what my sobriety looks like. I go back 6 months, I go back a year, I see that I've grown, I see that I've changed. It's like watching your hair grow. I don't see it, but if I look at the pictures a couple months back, a couple years back, I can see that I've changed. So in that respect, my sobriety has been absolutely and completely wildly uneventful. And I am so jealous if you don't have to do it that way, because it's so frustrating, because I'm so about the immediate. I want the fix right now. I can say that the things that I've done consistently right that have always shown up and saved me is that I work really hard at asking for help when I'm afraid. I did a thing in early sobriety when I told myself I didn't want to go to a meeting, that meant I had to go to a meeting. Kent Coleman also says in one of his talks, because I love him and he's amazing, he's my AA rock star. I've met him twice and I've gotten like wildly nervous. I'm like, ah, you know, like I'm so excited and it's just too much. I get over top. Anyway, he talks about that the only excuse for missing your home group meeting is a death in your family and it must be your own. If I'm in town, I'm at my meeting. I schedule my vacations around my meeting if I can at all possible. I don't miss it because that's my home. And when I don't show up for a week and don't tell anybody because, like, I forgot that I had something or whatever, or I forgot that I wasn't going to be back in time, or my home group's like, are you okay? What are you? You're always here. And that's what it is. Like, right, I'm always there. Like, I'm a creature of habit. I have a seat that I like. I don't freak out when it's not available. I just, my preference. But, like, that's where I go because that's my safe place. Like, my home group is my little puffy cloud to fall in. So when I feel the craziest, I know that that meeting's always going to make me feel better because it always does. And if it's not the meeting, it's the people, right? Like, I'm always going to feel better if I go there. I've always had a sponsor. It's not safe for me to be by myself. I need somebody that's there. And I'm kind of going through a thing right now where I moved and my sponsor's not comfortable sponsoring me because she thinks that I'm too far away from her. We disagree on that fact, and that's okay. So I have to find a new sponsor. And that's a weird and terrifying journey because she's the one that I finally did the steps with, and she's like, you know, and I'm like, you know, and I wanted to kick up all my shit and be like, you don't love me, you don't understand, because it's just like every other time in my life. And that's what it is. It's, that's her boundary, and that's okay. Like, I don't have to agree with it. But that's all right. And she's going to keep sponsoring me until I find somebody. Because I will. You know, I sponsor women as much as I can. But I also have to be realistic about the fact that sometimes there are times in my life when I'm not able to do that, and I'm not going to shortchange another woman. Because people showed up for me here. You guys showed up for me. And I don't want to not be able to do that. So my sponsee and I had to sit down and have a conversation that I'm not available right now. And that sucks. Because it brings up that part of me that wants to be useful and feel like I can't be right now. Because I'm doing this other stuff because my life is so amazing today. Like, my life has gotten so good. And to not be able to show up for AA really hurts. But I also have to know my limitations, and you guys taught me that. Like, I cannot be Superwoman. I cannot do all the things all the time. And sometimes what that means is that I have to take care of myself so that tomorrow, when I do have the availability, that I'm still sober to be here. Because when I stretch myself too soon, which is a thing that I do constantly, I'm not happy and I'm not joyous and I'm not free and I'm not of service to anybody like that. And I don't like when my AA has to change. You know, because I get really comfortable in the thing that I know that works for me. You know, and right now, I moved. I don't want to switch my home group. And I've made a commitment to show up there just like I always have. But I have to start going to other meetings because sometimes the meetings in Reading are just too far away. I don't want to meet new people. That sounds horrible. But the truth is, I went to a meeting and I met some really wonderful people, and they've been amazing. And I've called them and they've called me back. Because I went to a meeting and I said I was really scared about having to move, and I was really scared about having to have things change. And I didn't really know what to do with any of that. And they stayed after and they talked with me and they call me and they check on me to see how it's going. Because they know it's hard, because some of them have done it too. And that's what you guys taught me, right? Like, when I suit up and show up for other people, that's what I get back. Other people suit up and show up for me consistently, all the time. It doesn't always look the way that I want it to. I accidentally called the wrong woman. I meant to call one Bridget. Apparently there was two. We had a whole conversation. I got to the end of the conversation, and I asked her, did you talk to me after the meeting? And she was like, nope. I was like, okay. Fake Bridget. Right. But she was great, because now I have two Bridgets, and I talk to both of them now. And I have one is fake Bridget and one is real Bridget, so that I can keep them straight, because they sound a little bit alike. But that's what happens, right? Like, God provides me with these people when I need them. Okay. So I'll share really quick about how recovery has changed the relationships that I have. My dad and I, we do not get along because we're the same person. So that doesn't work out so well. I'm like, you know, my brother's the person my dad wants to be. I'm the person my dad is. And he doesn't really like to look at that. Because I have a tendency to fall just a little short of the expectation. Or that's how I perceived my life growing up. It was not reality. So, when I first got sober, I didn't tell my dad I went away to rehab. And I told my brother, who I lived with, don't tell dad. Or I said, don't tell anyone. Well, he thought anyone meant, you know, anyone. So he told my dad. My dad was really mad that I did not tell him that I went away to rehab. And he was like, he told my mom, she doesn't want to talk to you, that's fine, I don't want to talk to her either, me. And I was like, fine, good. And I didn't talk to him for about a year and a half. He texted me on my birthday and on Christmas and, you know, the regular stuff. And then at about a year and a half sober, I decided I'd start to try to be friends with my dad again and start trying to show up because I was a little less crazy and I could kind of understand why he was so crazy. And so that's what I did. I just would call him to say hello. And I didn't call him for anything. Just hello. And then he said, hey, I just made this new thing. Do you want to come over and try it? Because that's the thing my dad and I have in common is food. Food and television. And World War II. That's what we've got in common. Those are the things we're interested in together. And So that's what I started to do. I started to show up. I started to love him for who he chose to be and not who I thought he should be. Because the truth is I deserved a better dad. Probably most of us did. It's not what I got. This guy's what I've got. And I get to make a decision today, and that's the beautiful thing that Alcoholics Anonymous taught me, that I get to make decisions. I get to decide if I'm going to love this man for who he chooses to be, or if I'm going to hate him for the person he should be. Today I choose to love him for who he's capable of being and who he wants to be, even if that's not what I agree with. So I show up, and we started cooking together and hanging out. He's never asked me about rehab. I've mentioned it here and there that I'm in AA. We don't talk about it. And that's okay. And every month now we get together and we go to the Liederkranz and we have German food because that's what he likes to do. So that's what I do. And today I get to be the daughter that he deserves, even if he's not the dad that I deserve. He's crazier than ever. Like, just absolutely insane. And we have never been closer. Because the beautiful and amazing and incredible thing about this is my entire world can be insane. And I can be okay. This is not about any of that outside stuff. It's not about that you understand or that you love me or you say it's okay. It's if I'm willing to believe those things. And if I'm willing to do something different today. And because I choose to see the world differently, I choose to see the world as half full instead of half empty, my life is exponentially better, and I get to have a better relationship with the people around me. The way that my disease has infected my family, my friends, my life, my recovery infects them as well. If I'm better, we're better. Thank you for letting me share.